We continue reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, chapter 28, entitled Kapila's Instructions on Devotional Service. We have text 13 today.
13.
So please kindly repeat after me. Prasada Badanam Pujam.
Prasada Badanam Pujam.
Padma Garbha Runikshanam.
Padma Garbha Runikshanam.
Nilapala Dalashyama.
Nilapala Dalashyama.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead has a cheerful, lotus-like countenance with ruddy eyes like the interior of a lotus and a swarthy body like the petals of a blue lotus. He bears a conch, discus, and mace in three of his hands. Purport. It is definitely recommended herein that one concentrate his mind upon the form of Vishnu. There are 12 different forms of Vishnu which are described in teachings of Chaitanya. One can not concentrate his mind on anything void or impersonal. The mind should be fixed on the personal form of the Lord, whose attitude is cheerful. As described in this verse, Bhagavad Gita states that meditation on the impersonal or void features is very troublesome to the meditator. Those who are attached to the impersonal or void features of meditation have to undergo a difficult process because we are not accustomed to concentrating our minds upon anything impersonal. Actually, such concentration is not even possible. Bhagavad Gita also confirms that one should concentrate his mind on the personality of Godhead. The color of the personality of Godhead is described here as Nilotpala Tala, meaning that it is like a lotus flower with petals tinted blue and white. People always ask why Krishna is blue. The color of the Lord has not been imagined by an artist. It is described in authoritative scripture. In Brahma Samhita also, the color of Krishna's body is compared to that of a bluish cloud. The color of the Lord is not poetical imagination. There are authoritative descriptions in the Brahma Samhita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and many of the Puranas of the Lord's body, his weapons, and all other paraphernalia. The Lord's appearance is described here as Padma Garbha Runekshanam. His eyes resemble the inside of a lotus flower, and his four hands, he holds his four symbols. Conchal, disc, mace, and lotus. Om Agnati Miradasya Ram Shankara Chakshur Mirita Vena Tasmai Sri Shivaye Namah Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stahada Vena Utare Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dati Svaka Datikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinamandu Chayapate Gopesha Vikata Rangi, Raya, Dabeshwari, Vrishavan, Sudhedevi, Pranamami, Haribhye, Panchakalpa, Surubhyasa, Kripasi, Dubhaya, Dacha, Patitanam, Adhiyo, Vaishnaviyo, Namo, Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu, Nityananda, Shri Advaita, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lord Kapila is instructing his mother, Devahuti, on devotional service. And in this section, particularly we are dealing with the Ashtanga Yoga process, which is Yama Niyama Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. These are the eight stages of Ashtanga Yoga. And here, Kapila Dev explains the breathing process in the previous few verses, pranayama. And then pranayama helps us to concentrate the mind and meditate. And here he gives the insight on whom should we meditate. So gradually he is building us up to the point of giving us a vision of the Supreme Person. So, in this world, we experience suffering almost all the time. And this suffering actually serves as a catalyst to awaken our intellectual faculties. Whenever there is suffering, we become philosophical. And when we become philosophical, we begin to search for the ultimate cause of this suffering, which means also we search for the origin. What am I doing in the world of suffering if I don't want to suffer? So, then a fortunate soul may come to the process of bona fide yoga system. So, some person may come to the process of Ashtanga yoga, some person may come to the process of Bhakti yoga. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that Sankhya yoga, Buddhi yoga, Bhakti yoga, they're all the same. It's just that they're different in terms of practice, but the objective is the same. And we know from Prabhupada that in this age, it is almost impossible to practice properly Ashtanga yoga. You have to go to a secluded place in the forest, sit on a deer skin, all these different requirements are there, and meditate for years and years, silence the mind, forget the world, relatives, family, everything, just go to the forest. So it's very difficult, especially in Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is the age where we are the most unqualified to practice spiritual life. So the Western paradigm of history is very different to the Vedic paradigm. The Western paradigm is based on Darwinian Marxist ideas of evolution of species, and their idea is that the human being evolved from lesser species over a long period of time by accident. But the Vedic or the yoga paradigm is completely different. The yoga paradigm is based on devolution, that the species are created by the Supreme Person, and particularly he creates the common ancestor, who is Brahma, is the most complex being. Lord Brahma is the most complex being. And then from this most complex being, lesser beings appear. Darwin's idea was the common ancestor was the simplest living entity, and from this simplest living entity, gradually higher entities appear. But actually, in the yoga text is completely opposite. The most complex entity is first, and then from that complex entity, the lesser entities are coming. Because the complex entity contains all the genetic makeup of the lesser entities. So that's how we have, from Brahma's sons, we have the progenitors, Prajapatis, and then from the Prajapatis, they could produce few species at the time. Like one Prajapati with his wife could produce few species because they have the genetic makeup of few species within their bodies. And that's how we have this variety of species. And Prabhupada also explains that first was created the aquatics and the plants from these manus. They created first the lesser forms, the plants, so that they can create the atmosphere for the higher forms to appear. But again, it was a design. It was an intelligent design organization rather than a mistake, an accident. So we are in this world, and we have these different historic perspectives of two worldviews, the Western and the Vedic, the yoga worldview. And when people are searching for absolute truth, sometimes they relate to the Western, they kind of get satisfied with the Western worldview, but sometimes they see through it and they go to search for something deeper than that. A few days ago I received one small video by one person who was asking me what I think. And in that video they were showing how they're injecting DNA from a dead dog into the fertile egg of another dog. And they were saying this is the way that we actually reincarnated the dead dog, because we took the DNA from that body, we're injecting it into the egg, and now that same dog is reincarnated. So this is how the scientists are trying to create eternal life in their own way. So I told the person that actually the DNA cannot be created by chemicals, because DNA is extremely complex structure that is based on information. How can dead chemicals produce some complex information? So the DNA, first of all, cannot be produced by accident, because it's too complex, extremely complex. And for every protein, different DNA is required, so on and so forth. So much complexity is there. What a nice accident, huh? So, and I told him that the DNA is an information pattern, but it is connected to the biological body. The biological body is based on this information pattern, just like a shirt is based on textile pattern. Yeah, the DNA is like an information pattern, but the t-shirt is like a textile pattern. It's still there as a pattern to make the shirt. Okay, still designed intelligently by someone. And just like the body, physical body has to, just like the shirt is alive, in inverted commas, when someone wears it, in the same way, the body is alive when the soul or the non-chemical energy enters inside. You see? The body is alive when the non-chemical energy enters inside. So the DNA has no value unless the soul is inside. The shirt has no value unless the person takes it to wear it. So, in this way, we approach the yoga process intellectually. We're not just sentimentalists. We're not just thinking, I feel that the yoga process is correct, and just because I feel, it must be correct. No, we are thoughtful people, and of course, the Srimad Bhagavatam has given us a very clear description about what is really happening. So, in this particular verse, we are lifted to dhyana, meditation on the Supreme Being, and there's a clear description of what the Supreme, who the Supreme Being is. He has a cheerful lotus-like countenance with ruddy eyes like the interior of a lotus and a swarthy body like the petals of a blue lotus. He bears a conch, discus, and mace in three of his hands. In the fourth hand is lotus. So, Prabhupada is stating in the purport, definitely we have to focus on Vishnu, the Supreme Person, who is actually the originator of this devolutional process, this phenomenal world. There is an intelligent phenomenal mind behind this DNA, RNA, RRNA, protein, enzyme, cell, organ, body. So there is a tremendous phenomenal consciousness behind it. And that consciousness comes from a phenomenal supreme person. And here Vishnu is referred. Vishnu is just one aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is the Purusha Avatar. And even meditation on Purusha Avatar is perfection, because the Purusha Avatar is still incarnation of the Lord, of the Supreme Being. So here Prabhupada says in the purport there are 12 forms of Vishnu, which are described in teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So we know some of them: Garbhuta Kasaya Vishnu, Karanam Kasaya Vishnu, Kshiruda Kasaya Vishnu. This is the super soul of the universe, the supreme conscious entity being present within this world. And Prabhupada further states that in this age it is very difficult to concentrate the mind on something impersonal, therefore we are given that form. Even if we are imperfect and we concentrate on the Lord's form in somewhat of an imaginative way, you know, we sit down and we imagine Krishna the way it's described here. Krishna accepts this. Oh, my devotee is trying to imagine me and think of me. He's accepting this. He's a person. Even if it's not the direct vision of the form, even if we're just sitting and imagining that form because we read it in the Bhagavatam, Krishna is happy. He says, wow, look at my devotee. He is sitting down and he's envisioning me, and he is actually trying to chant the holy name to honor me. So in this way, we've been given this mercy to meditate on the Supreme Person. Meditation on the impersonal is very difficult and almost impossible, especially in this age. How long can you concentrate on a void or vacuum? Probably 1 second, because some thoughts will come inside the mind immediately. It's not really possible to meditate on void. Someone may say, well, if I practice over a period of time, I'll learn. But the idea of impersonal meditation is to void, to free the mind from all the material concepts that we have picked up from this world, so that we can enter the mind, so that we can fill it with spiritual concepts. But the personal meditation is why empty first, start to pour the real substance inside, And that real substance will take the contaminated substance. Just like we hear this example of if there is water that is contaminated by ink. I don't know if you heard this example. Right? You see in a glass, you see a glass of water, and then there is some ink inside. Someone put a couple of drops, so the water becomes different color. So there are two ways you can deal with this. You can take the glass and throw the water and fill it up. But there is another way. You start pouring water already inside and practically take out gradually the ink in that way. So this may sound more difficult, but actually it's easy in Krishna consciousness, because if you focus on Krishna, then the ink of material attachments becomes cleansed away very quickly, just because we are focusing on Krishna. And we become very happy. So here is the description. The Lord is cheerful, lotus-like countenance with ruddy eyes, like the interior of a lotus, swarthy body like the petals of a blue lotus. Prabhupada says, Krishna is described here as Nilotpala Dala, meaning that he is like that of a lotus flower with petals tinted with blue and white. People always ask why Krishna is blue. So I heard Jayapatakamara said one time, when you see him, you can ask him. Hey Krishna, why are you blue? But this is not a material blue, it is spiritual blue, and in one sense it represents the omnipresence of the Lord. In this world, the sky represents, the blue sky represents omnipresence, the space. So the color of Krishna is reflected in the sky. That's what Prabhupada said at another lecture. Why the sky is blue? Because Krishna is blue. Because Krishna is unlimited, the sky represents that unlimitedness. That's why the sky is blue. So this is very interesting. So these pictures that we see, they are not some imagination of an artist, like Prabhupada says in the Purport. They actually genuine descriptions of how Krishna looks. One time a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada, if I look at these pictures, and if I see Krishna one day, will I recognize him? Prabhupada said, yes, you will recognize him. The pictures are very close to what Krishna looks like. Yeah. The pictures are very close. So keep looking at the pictures and keep meditating on Krishna, because in that way we can develop a relationship with Krishna. We can become attached to his lotus feet. Mother Urmila said a few days ago that the more we meditate on an object or a person, the more we develop love for it. So if we meditate on Krishna, certainly we'll become attached to develop love. And what is anything, is there anything higher than developing love of Krishna? There's nothing really higher. Therefore, Krishna tells Arjuna twice in Bhagavad Gita, Manmana Bhava Matva, to always think of me. Become my devotee. Madhyaji Mam Namaskar, worship me and offer obeisances to me. And in that way you will come to me. So this is a very powerful process that enlightens us and makes us happy and fulfilled. When I was a child, like Krishna's age, how old are you, Krishna?
Seven.
About that age, 7, 8 years old. I really wanted to know what's going on in this world. But there was nobody to tell me. I'm asking parents, I'm asking teachers at school, neighbors, aunties, uncles, reading books, trying to understand. Nobody could give me anything conclusive. They just say something. It just happened, we're here, that kind of stories. Yeah, because I lived in an atheistic country. I was born in Bulgaria. There was no religion there. Forbidden by law. If anyone went to church and if they saw from the school some representatives of the school, they saw you going to church, they can expel you from school actually. few times in the ICU going again and again and again, they can expel the student, at least for some time, to punish him, to rectify him. And my mother said that my grandmother used to take her to school, to church. And then a few times they saw her and they expelled her for some time from school because they wanted to send a message very strongly that we don't want the new generation to believe in God. My grandmother was probably in her 40s or something, when she, 30s maybe, when she was taking my mother to school, primary school. And yeah, this dynamic was happening. So I didn't know anything and I was very unfortunate because I was second generation. This law was passed. My mother was first and I was the second. We were born in total ignorance, complete darkness. And I wanted to know, I was feeling in my heart there is some knowledge that I needed to learn, but nobody could explain to me what is going on. And when I read Prabhupada's books years later, maybe 22, 23 years old, then immediately I connected with these books. I felt, I understood how these books filled the void. There was a big void in my heart, and these books just filled the void. Like nothing else could fill it. So then I understood Krishna is a person, the Supreme Being is a person. But he is hiding us from ourselves at the moment. He is hiding primarily because we are not so serious to be in touch with him. I'm talking about the general populace. He is hiding from the people. And when you want to know him, he makes an arrangement, like he creates a temple, he sends someone, a representative like Prabhupada, or you get a book from somewhere and you read it. So he makes arrangements for those who are searching, but for those who are not searching, he hides himself. And even when we come to ISKCON or to Krishna consciousness, still to some degree Krishna is hidden. Because we are still not ready to fully have a relationship. We still have many anarthas. Anartha means bad habits. Our hearts can be filled with bad habits. Bad habit particularly means it stems from selfishness. We still have the desire to enjoy separate from Krishna. So if we want to enjoy separate from Krishna, then Krishna will not force himself on us. He will not force himself on us. He will just respectfully wait for our awakening. He may give us some opportunities, he may give us some chance to relate to us, but he will never force us. Because that is not an aspect of love. Love is never forced. If someone forces us to love them, we will never do it. So why do we expect Krishna to force us to love him? Some devotees were asking Devamrita Maharaj about it. He gave this example. If someone forces you to love them, will you accept his love? No? So why do you want Krishna to force you? So it has to come from ourselves. Therefore Krishna is a little hidden still. Although he is in the form of a deity in front of us, he has come in the form of the holy name, he has come in the form of prasadam, he has come in the form of shastra, but he's still a little hidden from us. In Bhagavad Gita 10:20, I think, Krishna explains, I am the super soul seated in the hearts of all living beings. And he says, I am the beginning, the middle, and the end. So I was thinking about it yesterday, how when we deal with people, it's actually we are dealing indirectly with Krishna because he is seated in their heart. You see. So if we offend someone or if we hurt some person, indirectly we are hurting Krishna because the super soul is present within the heart of that person. I'm sorry. So if we deal with people, we have to be very careful, or living entities, because Krishna is there. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj said, even we have to deal carefully with matter, because within the atom, Krishna is in matter as well. That's why we should be careful with all facilities that we've been given, cars, buildings, everything that we may have been offered to use in his service temporarily has to be taken care of, because like this table, within the atom of the table, the super soul is situated. I can't just crash the table in the corner and leave the room, you know, after the class. So we have to be conscious how we are dealing with Krishna all the time, because he is present within the heart of each and every living being, and as the super soul. And the living beings, they have the freedom to respond to us in different ways, and we have the freedom to respond to them. But then we can either please someone or we can displease, and Krishna notifies everything, knows everything. And then we get the specific karma that binds us in this world. He is like the eternal witness and permitter seated in our heart, exactly in that form that is described here, with the lotus flower, the conch, the mace, and the disc. Thank you, Hare Krishna. I have a taste of water. Krishna has appeared to me in the form of water. Thank you. So the 10th chapter, the whole 10th chapter is dedicated to meditating on Krishna by looking at the different phenomena in this world, opulences like the sun, the moon, the air, the ocean, like that. So water, etc. Krishna is represented everywhere. So the idea is to always think of him and see him everywhere. And in that way we can develop that affection, that attachment. We can see the essence. He says, within the living being, I am the soul, the super soul. Within the living being, I am the soul. So therefore, meditating on Krishna doesn't mean just, in our case, as Bhakti Yogis, doesn't mean just when we do japa or sitting in our room to meditate on him. But it's all about being present at each and every moment when we're dealing with each and every person. This is meditation on Krishna. In Kali Yuga, Bhakti Yoga, how what we speak to them, what we say to them, what how we deal with them is in one sense our consciousness towards Krishna. If we are respectful towards everyone, then that is more or less our consciousness towards Krishna. And if we are respectful to some people but disrespectful to others, that means we still have not grasped what Krishna is or who Krishna is. And if we are disrespectful to everyone, we are in complete tamaguna. And also Prabhupada said, the spiritual master actually represents Vishnu in this world, the super soul. And our relationship with the spiritual master is more or less reflecting the relationship with Lord Vishnu, the bona fide spiritual master, because the bona fide spiritual master is an instrument of the Lord. So the spiritual master represents the Lord in this world, and if we treat the spiritual master as we would treat God, that exactly reflects that relationship. So we have been given this process to reawaken ourselves by Srila Prabhupada, and these are some of the lessons that we can learn from reading Lord Kapila's teachings about the Supreme Person, meditation on the Supreme Person, and development of love, development of bhakti, bhakti yoga. One time I heard this quote actually by Hridayananda Goswami Maharaj, who says that the problem is not that we are attached to people, the problem is that we are not attached enough. In other words, we don't love them. We don't love them. We are attached for our sense gratification. But real attachment means to love others. Just think about that. And real attachment to others means to act always in a way for their spiritual benefit. So that kind of attachment is spiritual attachment, because Krishna is at the center. And in that way we don't have to be detached from relationships with people, because Krishna is at the center. So we have to act always in a way that is beneficial to them, and we should learn how to tolerate people's weaknesses. It is very important, practical, to learn how to love imperfect people. Because if you learn how to love imperfect people, you can actually help them, and you can help yourself to go above your false ego. It's very easy to love someone who is perfect. A gentleman, gentle person, gentle lady, someone is always respectful and kind. It's very easy to love such a person. But it's very difficult to love someone who has an artist. We rather avoid them, you know, that's how we feel. But if we see Krishna within the heart of that person, then we will not avoid, we will not disregard, we will not avoid them. We will actually become a well-wisher. Of course, as long as they are not offending us. But if they are just innocently imperfect beings, then we have to learn how to relate to innocently imperfect beings. And perhaps we are also innocently imperfect beings, and others too have to tolerate us. Sachidananda Swami Maharaj said something very interesting in one talk. He said, sometimes we have this utopian idea that if I am with devotees, I will never suffer. They will never hurt me in any way. And then we come to the temple, we come to devotional communities, and then after some time we get some hurt. Some devotees do something to us and we feel some pain. And then we think, why is this? Why? I'm here with Krishna, I'm here with the devotees, but I got hurt. Someone said this to me, someone cheated me, someone said like that, you know, how can this be, you know? Is this process real? Is Krishna real? We start to doubt. But Maharaj said that we have an allotted karma, you know, backlog of karma, all of us. We have that karmic baggage. And because we are no longer dealing with materialistic people, that karma has to come to us in some way or other. And unfortunately, it has to come through the devotees. And it's all meant for learning certain lessons. Both parties involved have certain lessons to learn something from this exchange. Therefore, there is suffering even in devotional communities. But the suffering is always connected with us misbehaving. If someone doesn't misbehave, he will never suffer, he or she. But if someone misbehaves, then they will suffer in some way. So we are still imperfect. We are on the path of self-realization. So we should expect all kind of difficulties to come in our way. But we should always remember that Krishna is within the heart of that living being that is hurting me, or I made an offense to them, and I should always see how Krishna will be pleased in any situation to resolve any difficulties that may appear while dealing with other people. It's very important. So our process is not about running into the forest, isolating ourselves, but rather our process is learning how to deal with others here and now. It's a direct process, because the spiritual world is all about relationships. So we're getting prepared for going. into the spiritual world and engaging in relationships, and it's like a refinement tool, you know, this bhakti process is to refine us. We also hear the example of diamonds have been developed under great pressure, and sometimes they picked up from the ground, they're full of dirt. So to get the dirt out of them, sometimes there is a system of rubbing them against one another. So rubbing them against one another means putting us together into a place where we have to interact with one another's dirt a little bit to become clear and to shine as the original diamond is. So this is meditation on Krishna. In our case, it is, yes, when we sit and chant japa, we can meditate on this form, but also when we deal with other devotees, other people, we should always remember Krishna is sitting in the heart of that person. You see, this is part of our process. To know Krishna is there, and we have to deal with that person respectfully, with affection. And that is called meditation on Krishna. So I don't see any other point here. Maybe we can have some discussions and questions. 8:30. Any comments or questions from the devotees? Yes, Namibu.
How to have a respectful, constructive dialogue with devotees when maybe one or more parties might not be willing to consider other opinions? Different devotees have different opinions. Maybe due to seniority or position or just stubbornness.
Yeah.
So how to have a respectful dialogue without causing offenses? Which is pleasing.
See, with devotees who don't accept different opinions. He's asking, how do we interact with devotees who seem to not to be accepting different opinions? Because they may think they're senior and we're junior, we don't know. Or because they're just stubborn and they just...
Or even vice versa, not necessarily senior also.
Junior.
Not necessarily senior.
Junior, but who think they know everything.
Yeah. Or could be any. Could be
just
any
general stubborn person.
Yeah. It's just in general how to have a respectful conversation.
Yeah.
When it's different opinions.
What I do first is I try to understand the person before I want to be understood. And I try my best to understand them. And then if I understand them, then I, like what they taught us in empathic listening, I try to express what I understood so that they can confirm, yes, this is what I mean. You see, that's empathic listening. You have to capture the content and the emotion of the person when they speak to us. And then you have to express it back to them. So you're saying, this is the content you gave, and this is your emotion, you're feeling disturbed because of this and this content. Is that it? They say, yes, this is it. So then when you understand how they feel, then Krishna will generally give us an idea how to deal with a person in a way that is beneficial to both sides. And usually, if people see that we're listening to them, they will be open to listen to us. Naturally, unless they're crazy or something like that. But the normal person, in my experience, if I listen to someone attentively and I try to understand what they say, they feel this, then they will also be eager to hear my point of view. And then, they can vice versa express what they understood, and if everyone is unclear, then you can come to an alternative middle ground where both parties are meeting and being satisfied in this conflicting issue. Yeah. So that's how I understand it. I think the stubbornness comes from lack of faith that we appreciate them, that we understand them. They are afraid to listen to us because they think we don't actually understand them. So they kind of almost like a rebel against our opinion because they think we don't understand them. But when the person understands that we understand them, they are more eager to move away from stubbornness. And that is again a dynamic of loving exchange, because if someone is upset with us or something, we have to show them some love, some affection, so that they can, their heat can calm down, and then we can have a, you know, a reasonable conversation where both parties are settled, both opinions are settled properly. So, you know, sometimes because of too much pain in relationships, we become impersonalists. We just say, no, I'm not going to deal with people, they're all useless, rascals, I'll just be on my own. And this is actually, it's a weakness, it's a spiritual weakness. Very, very big spiritual weakness. So we have to learn how to deal with difficult people. This was my point. We have to learn how to deal with imperfect people. And in that learning how to deal with imperfect people, we also become perfected ourselves. Our imperfections become removed. But if we move ourselves away from the exchange, then our imperfection remains and the imperfection remains. And we have to work with it. If there is a conflict, that means there is a problem within my heart. And I have to deal with that problem rather than avoiding it, ignoring it. The problem is only with that person. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. And that is not going to help us. So, be more sensitive to others. That's my answer. Thank you for the next question. Yes, Krishna Prabhu.
If somebody does an action and somebody else gives the reaction to the person, does that person who gave the reaction, does he also get the reaction?
Yes. Yeah. It's a
body push.
He says if someone acts badly towards someone, and this is the reaction, the karmic reaction coming towards a person, does the person who acted badly get the reaction also? Did you understand? Someone is misbehaving towards someone, and we know that person who is receiving the misbehavior, that's his karma, okay? Are you with me? And his question is whether the person who is administering the karma, who is misbehaving at present, will get a reaction. That's his question. It's a good question.
Very good.
Yes, he will get the reaction because he chose to administer the karma to that person. Yeah, because you're choosing to hurt that person, then you will take the karma. But if you choose not to, then you will not get karma. Or if you choose not only not to hurt and not to engage, but if you choose to help that person, you will become blessed. Especially to help that person in Krishna consciousness, to help them be more Krishna conscious, you will become blessed. That's the idea. So you've got many options to misbehave, to avoid, to do good. These three things are in material consciousness practically. And you have a transcendental behavior, which is you can respond to that person with the objective of pleasing Krishna. And that's transcendental behavior, and then you will not get karma for it. In fact, you will come closer to Krishna. If you have Krishna in mind, what do I do to actually please Krishna in relation to this person? I'm having a difficulty. Is okay? And thank you so much for your question. Radha Madhav Prabhu or who? Mataji. Mm-hmm. Oh, Mataji, yes.
Actually, karma means chain of actions and reactions.
Yes.
So, for example, we punch someone, he punches as a reaction, and
yes,
because he punches back, we punch him again, this creates chain of actions, reactions.
Yes.
And the karma would stop when we accept, okay, I got this punch because I have punched him, and I come with him back.
Yes.
if what he said, if we are keep returning back what we get, and we don't understand this is okay, the Saturn has to stop with us, so the chain of actions and reactions, which means karma, will not, you know, it will stop.
Yeah.
And you know, I could agree that sometimes with some envious people who are envious or too much, you have to distance yourself because that's what Rupa Goswami said. With those who are envious, you have to distance yourself, make friends with those who are equal or have similar propensities, and you have to serve those who are advanced. Because sometimes, you know, we just keep offending, you know, the people keep offending, keep making offenses.
Yeah.
And one thing which personally helped me about the respect you mentioned, Jayapataka Swami, he said, unless you offer respect to others, you will commit offenses. So whenever we think, is this my respectful attitude towards this person? The way I act, the way I speak, the way I do, is this respectful? If it's not respectful, you're committing offense.
Yes.
And for me, that was like a so simple formula when we make offenses, when we don't.
Very good, yeah. Do you get this, Krishna Prabhu? We should always think, if I deal with someone, whether I'm respectful. And if we are respectful, then we are not. We are safe from karma and offenses and reactions. So, it's a good question. Thank you. Thank you, Mataji, for your comment.
Wait, where do I get a shirt?
it's on what was the golokaware.com, I think.
Thanks.
Yes.
Sorry, what was that?
The shirt. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Gratura Srila Bhagavatam ki.
Jai.
Antigodivaishnava Vrindavana ki.
Jai.
Dai go premandi.